Okay. Ezras Hashem, we are in Malachim Aleph, Perek Chaf Beis. We're finishing up Ezras Hashem, but even if you only see, if you see the finish line right ahead of you, we're probably not going to finish this week, because we're going to have some parallel Prakim in Divrei Hayamim to see. Okay. So, Malachim Aleph. We finish the sorry story of Achav. And we've been seeing that his counterpart, the parallel king in Yehuda at the time, was Yehoshaphat. We spent a lot of time on Achav. And Malachim gives very little coverage to Yehoshaphat in a very basic way, for the usual reason that someone doesn't get much attention in Navi. And why is that? Because he was good, and everything was good in Yehuda at his time. So let's see what the Navi has to say.
It's a really good one.
Yeah, yeah. But like, So let's see. Yehoshaphat ben Asa. Pasuk Memal. Yehoshaphat ben Asa Malach al Yehuda Bishnas Arba LaAchav Melech Yisrael. Yehoshaphat ben Asa ruled over Yehuda in the fourth year of Achav Melech Yisrael. Yehoshaphat ben Shloshim V'Chamish Shana B'Molcho. Yehoshaphat was 35 years old when he took the throne. V'Esrim V'Chamish Shana Malach B'Yerushalayim. And for 25 years he ruled in Yerushalayim. This is again underscoring the point that that Abarbanel makes at the beginning of Sefer Malachim, that as a rule, the righteous kings had long reigns, and the wicked kings had short reigns, 2-3 years. The righteous kings, as a rule, ruled for decades. And I stress as a rule because there were exceptions to both rules, but in a general way. V'shem Imai. His mother's name was Azuva Bas Shilchi. Now, Vayelech b'kolderech Asa Aviv. He followed in the path of his father Asa. If you remember, we learned about Asa at length. Also, in Asa, Malachim was very sparing on the details of his reign, and we learned a lot of elaboration in Divrei Hayamim, if you remember. He never deviated from doing what was right in the eyes of Hashem. Ach. But there is some criticism. Habama Yisrael Saul. Like we've seen about quite a number of the other righteous kings. They did not eradicate the Bamas, the private altars. In his day, the people were still offering karbanas on private Bamas. Again, we're talking about altars for Hashem, karbanas for Hashem, but these were not allowed once the Beis HaMikdash was built. But this was one thing that even the righteous kings failed to eradicate.
Is that considered like a really, really bad event? Is that allowed?
It's not. Maybe it's Shkut Echutz. I'm not sure. Right. Would that be Shkut Echutz? Could be. I'm not sure. Right. Now, Ramosha David Vali says that the reason that he didn't do it, explained this about Achav also, there was a cheshbon in not doing it, and that is that they were competing with the influence of the idolatry in the 10 tribes. And there was, people in those days had spiritual needs. People needed to be involved in worship. Now, this was demanding in those days. You were expected to make the trip to the Beis HaMikdash and to satisfy your spiritual needs there. But people wanted the backyard bummers, and the fear was that if they wouldn't allow it, if they would eradicate that, people would start tending over toward the 10 tribes. That was the cheshbon in keeping the bummers there. Nevertheless, it is a criticism. Meaning, there was a reason for it, a pious reason, but nevertheless it was a criticism. And this is bringing home one of the big points that we keep seeing throughout Malachim, and we'll see it stressed again, that we prefer a core that is more perfect, even at the expense of losing people. If we can have a core that the cloud is at a higher level, we prefer that even at the expense of losing people, than to have looser standards, but a lot more people within the fold. Now, of course, if we're talking halacha lemaaseh, this obviously has to be qualified, etc., etc. It's also such a thing as you can maintain a core in a certain place, and you can have a clear distinction. So not very, if you can have the lower standards for those who need it, without it affecting the core, okay. But if we're talking about having a reality where the bummers is simply a non-issue, while actually a large part of the people would rise to the challenge of only sacrificing the Beis HaMikdash, but will lose some, we're actually saying here this is a big yesod with a lot of implications, that it's like Rabbi Gamliel said many times, Hashem prefers fewer and greater quality than larger numbers but lower quality. It's a harsh fundamental principle. This is part of saving a neshama. What's that? Chas v'shalom. We want them all to rise to these standards. But the truth is that this is part of the point. Saving a neshama, but at what cost? We will not at the cost of lowering the level of Klal Yisrael as a whole, because that is equally precious. Somebody told me I was doing a shiur elsewhere. I was doing a shiur elsewhere, and I told about I saw in a certain shul they had a like questions and answers, like that someone, they would put up a question for the rabbi to answer every week, right? And the question was, somebody said that somebody was asking about, I try to daven seriously, but everybody around me is talking, and it very much disturbs me, and etc., right? And would the rabbi please articulate what the parameters are when you can talk, etc., etc.? A long response, which was basically one big, beating around the bush. I'm never actually approaching the bush. Was a whole long thing about, first of all, the importance of communication between shul members so as to strengthen the ties, etc. And that's why, shul functions are such an important thing, because that's a chance for people to really connect, etc., etc. On and on and on and on about the importance of communication at the right time. Okay? And then when he got down to the question itself, so basically what he said is, look, I sit up at the Mizrach, I'm by myself, so I'm not really familiar with the problem. So I don't know, basically kind of say, I'm not sure what to say. As far as halachic guidelines goes, we'll address that at a different time. Okay? So that was like the end of the last sentence, and a very long response. So I was saying this over in kind of like a poking fun. Someone comes up to me afterwards and he says to me, I think that's the right way to go. People don't want to come to shul because it's too long, and if we would allow talking, more people would come to shul. If we allow talking, more people would come to shul.
Here in Beit Shemesh?
What's that?
Did this take place here? Or?
This took place in Beit Shemesh, not the shul. Not the shul. In Beit Shemesh, yeah. In Beit Shemesh. And basically saying that if we want to be able to keep more of our youth, etc., etc., we should not be makbir on talking in shul. He said to me, let me ask you, if it's a choice between someone being mechal Shabbos or allowing the talking in shul, these kids are going to be mechal Shabbos. If you're not going to allow them, I said, so just one thing, very simple. Anybody who's been a little bit involved with youth, as in if you have two kids, okay, anybody a little bit involved with youth understands that there is not a situation of a kid who, if you let him talk in shul, then he'll come to shul and he won't be mechal Shabbos. Really wants to be mechal Shabbos, but if you let him come to shul and talk, then he'll stay on the path. Right? Okay? So that's number one. The whole thing is, putting it that way is a little ridiculous. Whatever the case is, there's an argument being made. We can have so many more people being attracted to shul, etc., etc., if we will allow it to be a social center and let davening get pushed to the side.
Conservative Judaism.
Yeah, basically. But you know what? Even if he's married to the Taina, the answer is really our answer. No, we would prefer to have a place where a shul is a shul. Where a shul is a shul. I'm not getting into the fact that that's one of the only things that the Shulchan Aruch says about a person who talks during daf the wrong times in davening is Godol Avreinah Minisoy, right? Sin is too much to bear. And where the Mishnah Berurah says that every shul should have people who go around making sure the people keep quiet, etc., etc. Setting that aside, okay? It comes back to our principle. Yes, we would rather know that Klal Yisrael is an institution called a real shul, right? Where there are still people who come for the experience of, yeah, 2 hours. You know what? Make it an hour and 45 minutes of pure, sterile davening, right? Even if it means a fewer, a smaller group, yes? Even if it means a smaller group. But, what's that?
This is a scenario we have when people are never moving the bamas and say, it's a long, long, long standing issue that's never failed for the people in Yehuda. But, do we know for sure that, like, for example, you know, like, I mean, maybe these guys came to, like, came to listen to this, but supposed to come to the garden, but maybe, you know, he wanted to bring a korban todah every Rosh Chodesh, and it's just too much to walk all the way from Haifa, all the way to Yerushalayim, and then, like, here, kill,
sure,
like, 2/3 of the month, like, you know, on the road, right? And he says it's convenient for me, like, I mentioned it for obvious reasons. It sounds like it's just impossible for them, impractical for them to just get to the best of the place, like, to do as much.
Presumably,
what am I supposed to do? Like,
presumably, what exactly what you're saying is the pshat. Presumably, that is the pshat.
And for that, is this still being on a lower level than a higher level?
Because at the end of the day, Bama is also. At the end of the day, it's also.
But they can't get. They need more ruchnius, and they can't get it. Like, it's the,
you want to say that it's midin oynes? It's like pikuach nefesh. It's also, right?
Somebody needs. He needs his tefillah. He's like, there's no tefillah, set tefillah yet at this point in time. For Bas is technically the main highway to connecting with Hashem at this point in time.
Right.
Like, you know, they have from Moshe Rabbeinu till now.
Yes.
Right?
And that's
so they have to wait, like, you know, till Sukkos to get there, like, to come to this.
Yes. Yes. That is the halakha. The spiritual need is A, it is not a reason to override the issue. That's number one. Okay. A need is a need. It's not a right. It's not a reason to override the issue. It doesn't justify overriding the issue. But besides that, all that is really part of the point. Hashem wants it to be a situation that the Beis Hamikdash is the heart of Klal Yisrael. And therefore, what Hashem is actually saying is that, yes, I would prefer that you bring fewer karbanos, but when you do, you go to the Beis HaMikdash and gain the full experience of coming to a Beis HaMikdash. Once there's a Beis HaMikdash, part of the point is that once there's a Beis HaMikdash, when there's a central place of Avodah, that we described earlier, the Malbim says how that was the heart of the people to treat there. I use the heart of the people in a figurative way. We have to understand what the Beis HaMikdash was for the people. The Malbim says, what is a heart? How does the heart work? The blood comes up to the heart, gets vitalized, right? And then it's expelled to the farthest corners of the body, right? It loses its vitality, and sluggishly makes its way back up to the heart, right? And the heart is the center of the vitality, right? The Malbim says that's exactly what the Beis HaMikdash was. The people would come to the Beis HaMikdash and the Sholish Yigalim for an injection of spiritual life, an injection of spiritual vitality that set them aflame. They went back to Be'er Sheva, okay, to the farthest corners of Eretz Yisrael, and it started wearing off. By the time it wore off, it was Pesach time. They came back, right? The blood that had lost its oxygen, right now it's coming back, dehydrated, ready for the next injection. That was the system of the Shalosh Yigalim. And that was what the Beis HaMikdash did for Klal Yisrael. I have to realize that today we are a dehydrated Klal Yisrael. You must realize that. Okay, so today, where do we get that vitalization from? We don't have it. We don't have it. But the description of what the Beis HaMikdash did for Klal Yisrael in those great days, when you came to a place of, besides just the spiritual properties, being exposed to the intense levels of Avodas Hashem that was going on there, being exposed to the people who frequented the area, from the Sanhedrin sitting in the Lishkas HaDozis right off the Beis HaMikdash, to the Kehanim Ba'avodasam, and the Levim doing their thing, which this was something that inspired a person in an intense way, and And also the people who were frequenting the Yerushalayim, the Beis Hamikdash precinct, were Nazirim, Nevi'im, etc., etc. A person came away from there on a spiritual high. And therefore, that was part of the purpose of the Isser of Tamis, was to force people to get their spiritual fueling from there. And on the contrary, Hashem is saying, yes, I prefer that you starve yourself a little bit more spiritually, but you have to do it in the top quality way, even if it's fewer times in the year.
So we laugh at the once a year Jew comes in Yom Kippur, but like this is practically that kind of scenario. Like, they come in 3 times a year, and that's all they get.
Well, bear in mind, people daven 3 times a day from time to beginning. There was very a live connection going on in all sorts of ways.
But
compared to the Beis HaMikdash, it wasn't. That's right. But what it was, again, it was what you're talking about, the Yom Kippur Jew, but not just that he comes and does the services. We're talking about people who came away spiritually filled, right? And that enhanced, that affected the quality of their spiritual life until the next time. Like they were living on a very high level.
But this was part of the problem. Because they came home and they said, now what? Like, now we have to wait like 4 months to the next visit? Like,
no, but again, we're talking also about just the connection you live with in the interim. Right? These people operate on a very high level of Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem, etc., in their day to day until the next time. It's true. You're right. What you're saying. That euphoria of actually being there was spaced. But in terms of the enthusiasm that they came away with, and in terms of the high that they were operating on the day-to-day, right? It's like, you know, have you been to, before Yom HaMiroyim, you've been to a most amazing shiur that was like a life-changer, and you felt yourself walking away on air afterwards? The effect is limited. But that was that a million-fold, right? It wasn't just the shatz mais of the shiur that you feel like on a high. But you go home, okay, in our case, when we're talking about that shiur, the next day, right? But no, this carried over for a long time. They were on a high for a long time as a result of the experience of the Beis HaMikdash.
They had Shabbos.
What's that?
They also had Shabbos.
So all the different milestones in the Jewish calendar were very much enhanced by the fact that they had been at the Beis HaMikdash sometime in the last half a year. The Shabbos was a different Shabbos, that's right. The Shabbos was a different Shabbos. The tefillin was a different tefillin. And also, the davening was a different davening. They didn't have the formal tefillahs 3 times a day. But people davened their own davenings 3 times a day, mamish from time beginning. No, not the tzibur. On the contrary, you see in the Khazari that when there was a Beis HaMikdash, even davening the tzibur was discouraged. Any tzibur avoida was the Beis HaMikdash.
I don't believe in that the real Mishkan, the Beis HaMikdash, is the heart. The person should purify their heart. That's the emphasis. If you have a private bama, you know, you pour out your heart over there, you know, maybe that's what some people needed more than all the...
So again, I'm saying that's what people needed, but that didn't justify it. Right? Still didn't justify it.
You wanted to have everybody into the...
Well, first of all, the basis is, before getting into everything we're explaining, is that Lamaise is an issue. That's the fact that people have that spiritual need is exactly the point. Don't, right? You have to follow Hashem's instructions to spirituality. Right? You can't do what feels good. That's a part of this issue. Right? You can't do what feels good. Right? Okay. My girls missed the Rosh Chodesh thing at the Kotel because they're in Beit Shemesh. They couldn't make it to the Kotel at 6:30 on Friday. That was Friday? Friday, to be there at that thing. But what's that? They had the women of the wall there. They were going to come with a group of 1,000 women. It ended up 50. But they were going to come, the women of the wall were going to come with a group of 1,000 women to hold a special Rosh Chodesh service on Friday. So Reb Chaim Kanievsky said that all the high school girls in Yerushalayim should go and just jam the place from 6:30 in the morning. All the high school girls of Yerushalayim were at the Kotel from 6:30 in the morning, just so there shouldn't be space. Okay? So even though my daughter learns in Yerushalayim, she couldn't make it at 6:30, so she stayed home that day. but yeah, that's what they did.
Did you see pictures of it?
No, I didn't.
Amazing.
I'm sure it was a sight to see. Of women.
In the
Esoscasha?
Yeah, but stretching all the way to Majet, because it was so crowded. Like,
the external
public, over 10,000 people in the room,
thousands and thousands. So a friend of my daughter's was there, came over on Friday. She had been there, and she described to us. She said that she got into an argument with one of these women. They said they were going to come with 1,000. They scraped together 50. A few of them they had to bring from the States. So she met one of these women who had come from the States. She was brought in. The woman is telling her that you can serve God in many ways. You can serve God in many ways. A whole lecture, right? You can serve God in many ways. And yes, you can serve God through Hinduism, through Buddhism, etc., etc. All kinds of different ways. And you do it this way. So one thing I thought to myself was, what you need to tell them is, so why tefillin? Who said that's a form of serving? I don't know. Why that? Like, put something else on. Well, it's because it says in the Torah. Oh, so God does say what he wants? Does he or doesn't he? Right? If there's no such thing as a God, if everything works, then where'd you come up with tefillin from? Right? You do agree that God said what he wants. So what do you mean that anything works? Okay. Now, so that's one criticism on Yahi Shafat, right? Another criticism is, first let's just see it as a fact. Pasuk Mem Hei. By Ashlem Yahi Shafat the Melech Yisrael. Yahi Shafat made peace with the king of Israel. We already saw, right? We saw how they were operating as allies. Rashi says, you have to realize that this had a lot of historic significance because this had not been the case since the split between Yisrael and Yehuda. They had always been at war. Right? And this was the first time that there was a situation of peace, and as we'll see soon, not only was there peace, but they actually became a chutanim. Yehoshaphat married his son Yehoram off to Achab's daughter. So, the Malbim, the Moshe David Bali, etc., say that this is the next thing on the list of criticisms. The fact that he made peace and created an alliance with the king of Achav was another criticism. Now, this is again underscoring the point we made, because the truth is that if you think about it, this is almost like something to aspire for, to manage to create a union once again between Yehuda and the 10 tribes, and even more than that. The Moshe David Bali says this in Kabbalistic terms, or Rebbe Gamliel says in very practical terms, that Yehoshaphat's intent was to start drawing them back, start drawing them closer. If there's a means of reconnecting, start drawing them closer. But once again, it comes back to the same point, which you see is a recurring theme through Tanakh. Do not draw them closer if it will come at the expense of the standards that are in Yehuda. If it's going to contaminate the standards in Yehuda, which it very much did. Now, at this point in history, we have a lot of historic experience to have learned that lesson very well. But at that point, they didn't. The first one who learned that lesson, if you remember, was Shlomo, right? Shlomo had his campaign of world kiruv, right? And we saw that rather than achieving that dream that he had, he was blamed for creating the first cracks into which foreign influence started infiltrating. This is subtler than that, because here we're not talking about reaching out to the Goyim, right? Here we're talking about Jews, right? We're talking about reconnecting with them and bringing them back. But nevertheless, we're saying, not at the expense of the standards in Yehuda. It could be done other ways. This is important to realize in Kiruv also, that it has to be planned such, it does not mean that we just open ourselves up now to completely just let all levels mix. That's not what it means. It has to be very, very clear that the standards are being absolutely kept, right? And then you can reach out or allow in if you can ensure that the standards will be safeguarded. So here, yes, you know, Shafat is, it's once again that sad phenomenon of the very good intent a very pious intent, almost like dream of Klal Yisrael intent, of reuniting the 10 tribes and actually bringing them back, which ended up backfiring, and it was taka held as a criticism against him.
He didn't just want peace.
What's that?
I don't know, he was arbitrary. He was just peace, because there was a
war. So all the pasuk here says is peace. But he actually married his son off to Achav's daughter.
That's how you do a treaty in those days. But then you have to...
So you know what? You know what? We'll actually see later. That wouldn't have been acceptable. Because if the peace means opening up that breach to allow the foreign influence, we don't want that peace. We'd rather that there be a state of war and rely on Hashem to help us out there, especially since, as we're going to see soon, keeping up to the high standards earned them very great Siyata D'Shmaya. Right? So now, the Yeser Divrei Yehoshaphat and the rest of the story of Yehoshaphat, Ugvarasa Asha Asa, that's what Sir Bavigda Miller said about Kilum. He said that, don't get me wrong, we aren't undermining the importance of Kilum. What we're doing is giving it, not just making it into an all-out concept, but it's like, you know, Sifrei Shulchan Aruch that has clauses and Sifrei Tanim, right? And it has to be broken down properly. So when someone asks Rabbi Miller, and I think this is such a profound way of putting it, should a yeshiva man go out to do kiruv? So Rabbi Miller said, the answer to that question is, so answer that with another question. If you see a person drowning, should you jump in and save them? The critical importance of jumping in and saving them is clear, right? The critical importance of jumping in and saving them and the value of doing that is obvious and indisputable. But there's a question that has to be asked. Do you know how to swim? Right? Do you know how to swim? You jump in to save a drowning person without knowing how to swim, all likelihood, forget knowing how to swim, without knowing how to save people, right? If you do know how to swim, without knowing how to save people, in all likelihood, both will end up drowning. Both will end up drowning. So, you have to know what you're doing. He said, that's the answer here also. We're talking about saving drowning people. We're talking about saving drowning people. But as important as saving a person is, you're not going to gain anything if you just drown along with him. Right? So now, okay. The Yetzer HaKodesh, Asher Nish'al B'mei Asa Aviv, and the remaining harlots. Asa had made a campaign of trying to get rid of the Kedeshim, but there were still some remaining, some of the harlots that remained from the day of Asa, his father. Bi'er min ha'aretz, he eradicated from the land. Meaning he took all of Asa's campaigns to their finish. Apparently both. What's that? Going on, right. Umelech ein ba'edoyim nitzav melech. Now at that point, in Edoyim there was no king. There was only an acting governor under Jewish rule. The Jews had control over Edom at that time. This is being stressed because we're reminding you, this is going to change soon. It's going to change soon. We're reminding you that in Yehoshaphat's days, as long as the standards are still what they needed to be, Edom did not have a king, they were still under Jewish control. Now, what I want to do now is move over to Divrei HaYamim Beis, Yud Zayin, which gives us a little bit more description of what was going on in Yehoshaphat's time. Because when we say that, what's that?
Going after the
creation. If I remember correctly, it said the same thing about Asa, that he started but didn't finish. Because I have to understand, when we hear that things were very good, that doesn't just mean that there were no problems. When we talk about things being good in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, it means that there was a passionate, active, sustained dedication among the people. So Avodas Hashem, they were operating, it wasn't a static situation, that things were good and people weren't doing Averis. It means that the nation was very, very actively busy with intense growth. And that's described in Divrei Hayamim. It's not described here. Here, Malachim is, okay, there it's Beseder, we don't need to talk about it too much, right? Let's see how it says in Divrei Hayamim. So Divrei Hayamim Beis, Perek Yud Zayin. Reads like this. Vayimloisha Yishafat Benoi Tachtav, after Asa died, Yishafat his son reigned instead of him, Vayishchazek Al Yisrael. And as great as Asa was, his greatness over Klal Yisrael was even greater. Meaning, here we're talking materially. He became a very, very great and prestigious king, even in just material terms. He put many reinforcements, meaning very great military presence. He very much beefed up the military in all of the fortified cities of Yehuda. He very much also enhanced, apparently, the government systems. He put governors all around Eretz Yehuda. And also in the cities of Ephraim, if you remember, Asa, the righteous king who preceded Yehoshaphat, had actually gone to war against the 10 tribes as a righteous representative of Hashem, and he captured many of their cities, who then rejoin the fold. That's another way of it didn't have to be through becoming a mechutim. Okay? So now, Vayhi Hashem im Yehoshaphat, and Hashem was with Yehoshaphat, ki halach tedarkei David aviv, because he followed in the ways of David his father, right? David was not a person who just static, didn't do aveiros, right? David was a lifetime of passion and intensity, right? And always pushing himself, relentless growth. And he did not go after the Baalim. Now, the Mefarshim knows. He says that he followed the path of David, right? So he also didn't go after the Baalim, right? So Rashi says that the stress is that this was an enhancement to David's Avodah, because David wasn't competing with a reality that already existed. The Shaphat was resisting the influence that already existed in the 10 tribes. He sought out the God of his fathers, and he followed his mitzvahs, and he did not follow the example of Israel. And it has always the reciprocal effect. Hashem established the kingdom in his hands. And everybody passed up taxes to Yehoshaphat, which reflected the material plenty in general. And he had very, very great wealth and prestige. And his heart became very high in the ways of Hashem. We'll explain, that's a very important pasuk. We'll explain what that means momentarily. And he eradicated the bamos. Didn't we say that he didn't? So either this refers to any remnants of foreign idolatry that still remains, or, and this is also classic of the Navi, he did try to remove the bummers. Just that since he didn't get it all the way, or didn't make this into as enthusiastic a campaign as the other things, so he didn't remove the bummers. Even if he removed 70%, but he didn't remove the bummers. That would be classic Navi style. Okay? So now.
What do you mean? I'll just come over here.
What's that?
I mean, I'm not passing over here like in Boston. I don't think that he didn't remove the bombers. It says that I'm going to remove the bombers. I mean, maybe he tried.
That's a good deal. That's a good deal. Right? So now, what does it mean by Yigbal?
When eradicating the bombers, does it also mean eradicating the people who are bombers?
I don't know. It probably have depended on the circumstances, if that was needed or not. I don't know. We probably assume that not. Outlawed it and had police going around and confiscating them or smashing them. Now, what does it mean? He said that Vayigbaliboy bedarkei Hashem, his heart rose high in the darkei Hashem. So Rashi says just that he soared spiritually. This is a man who is constantly on a trajectory of growth. But the Mitzvah says, and this is very classic in understanding what kingship in Yehuda meant, that was where he saw his prestige. Meaning, we said that this was a man who flourished in military terms, in terms of wealth, in terms of prestige, etc. But as a king, what were the agendas? Where was his pride? His pride was in the achievements that he had in these areas of the standards, the spiritual standards that he created for Klal Yisrael. His agendas were not the wealth, the might, etc. Those things came because he was focused on this. But that wasn't his agenda. Vayig Balibay, where did he find his pride as a king? What did he want to go down in history as? Right? That he would bring the people to these standards. That would be his pride as a king. That's the king of Beis David. Right? That's a classic way of describing when we say a person who went in the way of his father David. And the Rabbag says that Vayig Balibay means his ambitions. His ambitions, the Rabban says, were lehafli. They were exaggerated. Right? They were excessive. It was like his ambitions in terms of that, what he wanted to achieve in Darkei Hashem, were over the top. And he achieved them. Ubishnas, and now it describes a little bit what this actually meant. Ubishnas shalosh lemalchai, in the third year of his reign, shalach lesarav, he sent his officers, Ben Chayil, Ul Oivadia, Ul Ischaya, Ul Nesanel, Ul Michayahu. He sent all these officers around, Lelamed Ba'ar Yehuda, to teach Torah in the cities of Yehuda. Meaning, this is what he wanted. He wanted a high standard of Torah prowess in Klal Yisrael. The nation should be a nation of G'dayle Torah. Okay? The Imayim HaLevim. Along with them, he sent the Levim. Shmayahu, Unisanyahu, Uzvadyahu, Vasoil, Ushmiramois, Behindosan, Vadeniyo, Vitavio, Vitoy Vadeniyo, Halavihim, okay? Vimayam Elishama, Behoyram Akehan. A whole slew of Nevi'im and Kehan. So he sent officers and Nevi'im and Kehan. So why officers and Nevi'im and Kehan? So Nevi'im and Kehan were expected to be the Torah teachers, right? That we know from other sources also. Levim Kehanim were expected to be the Torah teachers. The officers were there to enforce the campaign. Meaning they weren't there putting up signs and whoever showed up, showed up. Torah study and growing in Torah and becoming Talmidei Chachamim was imposed on the nation by the king, right? He sent great Torah teachers and he sent policemen, right? When it was time for the shir, there was curfew. Okay? And they taught in Yehuda. They went around with the Sefer Torah of Hashem. And they circled in all the cities of Yehuda. And they taught the nation. So this was to realize all the things that we're saying about the problems going on in the 10 tribes. What was Malchus Yehuda at that time? Right? We're talking about the land of Torah, right?
That kind of forced education works.
What's that?
Forced education works.
Yes. Yes. Chinuch works, right? You create, first of all, you have to understand. Everybody appreciated the standards, right? That wasn't the problem. Just the problem was that, I could use a forced... it would do me good if I had
to send the kids to school. Do you want to go? No,
but that's right. Then you create a framework, and you know, people will ask, what about Bechira? There's always Bechira. The question is how much a person wants to take this ball and run with it. But you took the ball and you moved, right? Yes, you brought up everybody up to a certain standard that you had no choice. But don't worry, there was plenty from that point. Anybody could decide quite how high they wanted to soar with it. And what was the effect of all this? And this created a situation where they became, Hashem caused them to exude a certain awe and fearsomeness in the nations around. They just got a certain untouchable view Okay? And they never fought Yehi Shafat, right? That's what we said before. To ensure his peace, we wouldn't have to make shidduch treaties with anybody, right? Hold up these standards, you need nothing else. And Rashi says, yes, this was because they learned Torah. Baruch Hashem, we're not a group that needs to have this stressed. But this is so much of a lot of the controversy of today's, right, of many of the hot issues today, really revolves around the understanding that when Klal Yisrael is holding up to a high Torah standard, they need a lot less protection. Right? So you can say that in one of two ways. You need to say that, yes, we need the line de Torah because they are a very, very important force in the security of Klal Yisrael. Right? To be obvious. But it even goes a step further, right? This is a very irritating story about the Chazon Ish, that when he had his famous meeting with Ben Gurion, right? The famous legendary meeting with Ben Gurion. So, and they were arguing. So at one point, Ben Gurion said to him, so, you know, in your mind, all the youth should be studying Torah. So, if there would be a war, would you send everybody to the front with rifles or with Bava Kamas? So the Chazon Ish answered him. He said, I'll tell you a story. He said, there was a wagon driver driving on the roads in the freezing Russian winter, right? And he was shivering, and his Bamish didn't know what he was going to do, and he felt like his ears were falling off. So he just couldn't handle it anymore. He took snow. If you rub snow on your ears, ironically, it could actually warm up your ears, right? So he took snow, and he rubbed the snow on his ears, and he got some relief, and he said, Baruch Hashem, it's winter. If it wouldn't have been winter, where would I have gotten snow to warm my ears? Right? So that was the Chazon Ish's answer to Ben Gurion's question. Okay. So in other words, right, in case we need to spell it out, Baruch Hashem, we have an army because now that we have an army, now that not everybody is learning, we have wars and we have people to fight those wars. Okay. Now, part of this effect was that all the plishtim around, they were paying tribute to Yehi Shafat, right? All their traditional enemies. The kesef masa, gifts and money of an argim, mevim loitzayin elim shivas alafim mishvamiyas, utiyashim shivas alafim mishvamiyas. So they're bringing a tax, the Arab nations around, whatever that was, would bring him 7,700 sheep and 7,700 goats. Vayi Yehoshaphat holech v'godel ad lemala, and Yehoshaphat was simply his flourishing higher and higher. Vayiven Yehuda b'iraniyos v'ari miskanos, and he built Yehuda into very great towers and fortresses and for very great also cities of storing. Umelacha rabba hayale bari Yehuda, there was very much great industry in the cities of Yehuda. And the land was full of mighty warriors. They had the warriors. They always had an army. We'll see next week. There was an army. But we'll see exactly what it looked like. Okay. And then Dirayamin goes on to actually describe, list all the different officers that he had over which jobs. But okay, that'll be that for this week. Next week, I hope Bezos Hashem that we're going to have another parallel parak to do in the Rayami, but maybe we'll finish. Okay.